Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, climate activist Greta Thunberg was in Switzerland today with 10,000 people in the streets. Signs that read, "Wake up and smell the bushfires." And look, you know, while you've got this massive fire going on, as Greta Thunberg points out, nothing has been done. We're in a new decade. It's a new year. Nothing. No government has made any real move towards solving our climate problems. Nobody has done anything of any real value to this point. And here in the U.S., we're almost going backwards, it seems. And for me, you know, you look at the reality as if you think the refugee problem that's going on because of poverty is bad, wait till the climate refugees start. Wait till people are running away from brush fires. Wait till they're running away from no water and land that is unusable. It's just crazy. And here to share some thoughts on our climate issues, because today is the Fridays for Future Movement Day. I've asked Joe Sandberg to come talk with us. Joe, thanks for taking time for us. Did I lose you?
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you taking some time. So what do you think of this? I mean, you've got this 17-year-old activist who's saying, look, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Well, I think we have to act urgently. Frankly, I'm disappointed that Senator Klobuchar is still supporting fracking as a quote-unquote transition fuel. We don't have until 2045 or 2050 to wait. And we have to do everything we can in our individual lives right now as well. As you noted, governments, including our own, are not taking bold enough action. And the harsh reality is every single one of us is responsible too. For example, I'll bet you so many people listening tonight, Rick, have their money at a bank while they're sleeping, using their money to fund climate destruction. Like, there's so many choices we make every single day in our life that we're not conscious about that are affecting the climate crisis.
Right. It's probably one of those six banks that ended up with $32 billion tax windfall from Donald Trump.
Absolutely. So I'd say to everyone listening tonight, everyone who's worried about the climate crisis, what's your money doing while you're sleeping? What's your money doing when you spend it at different stores? Is your money at a bank that's using your money to make loans to fossil fuel companies? Do you know? Because, you know, we can't just complain about what our government's not doing and sit here in our own lives and not do everything we each possibly can. And it starts with making sure our money is aligned with our values around climate.
Right. So the hope from your end would be that people would go, as co-founder of Aspiration, a bank that does some of the things that you're talking about, change your accounts to move over to Aspiration, right?
Absolutely. Look, I founded Aspiration for exactly this reason. There's tens of millions of Americans who care a lot about the climate crisis, but don't know that while they're asleep, their bank is using their money to fund the climate crisis. And the dirty little secret about the business community is that it's actually really easy to get businesses to change their behavior. If just a couple million of us pulled our deposits out of banks that funded fossil fuel, you'd be astonished by how fast banks would stop lending to fossil fuel companies. And right there, we have the answer. There's millions of us who are passionate about fighting the climate crisis that still have our money at banks that are using our money for dirty fuels. So for everyone listening, you wake up tomorrow, you got to look where your money is and ask, is that bank making loans to fossil fuel? Because if it is, you got to move to a place like Aspiration, or, you know, there are other places. You know, I don't want to come and just promote the organization I founded, but I do want to say, get your money out of a bank that's funding fossil fuel.
Well, how do you know if a bank's funding fossil fuel?
Well, you can go
online.
Or
are they all doing it?
Well, they're not all doing it, but unfortunately, all the banks that have most of the customer deposits, right, all the big ones where you probably have your money, all of them are doing it. And if you Google research it, you'll be able to find really quickly whether your bank is funding fossil fuel. Honestly, type your bank into Google, type fossil fuel funding, you'll get the answer real quick. And if you want to change, Aspiration is a great choice, but you can also Google other fossil fuel-free banks. You'll find options. Obviously, I'm biased and think Aspiration
sure.
is great.
No, you guys do a lot of really good work. I like the fact that, you know, some of the profits go towards, you know, the causes that people can get behind. I think that's a great thing.
Thank you. Thank you.
But here's the thing. I mean, you know, no one should have any of their money in the big banks, especially the six that got the $32 billion windfall.
Exactly. And, you know, if I can be a little sharp, you know, if your money is at one of those big banks, you're kind of losing your right to complain about the climate crisis.
And a lot of other things, I would argue, too, especially our tax code. But here again, this is one of those issues that I think we've been, as Americans, have been led to believe it's, yeah, you know, it's, we can be for the climate and the environment as long as it doesn't, well, it doesn't inconvenience us.
Well, yeah, we just don't have the luxury of that attitude anymore. I mean, for heaven's sake, there's a whole continent that is on fire. Anyone who isn't following what's going on in Australia needs to pay attention, because that's the future of every continent if we don't get our act together.
But here again, that's over there. That's not here. That's somebody else's problem.
We just, yeah, we don't have the luxury of that attitude. That's the reason we are in this place, is we've had that attitude for decades, including in the Democratic Party. And frankly, I put more blame at the foot of the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. You know what the Conservative Party is going to do. You know the Conservative Party is not going to stand up for working people.
Right.
The reason we're in this mess is because the Democratic Party has fallen short of its responsibility to fight for working Americans, of its responsibility to fight to ensure we have a sustainable planet to inhabit. And, you know, I'm sure many listeners read the article that David Brooks wrote in the New York Times.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up here in a minute.
Oh, my gosh. If anyone wants to be really angered, read the column David Brooks wrote today, where he basically accused Bernie Sanders of being wrong about so many class issues he's raising. And his main point of evidence is, well, for the last couple of years, the wages of low-income earners have grown faster than the wages of the richest. For the last couple of years, my God, that doesn't make up for a half a century of wage stagnation for low-income people. You know, this isn't about class war. This is about seeing the reality that 8 out of 10 Americans are living paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
Americans are dying younger. Longevity of Americans has shrunk now for 3 straight years. Infant mortality in America is rising. This isn't some academic, let's all feel good about each other exercise. America has a poverty crisis. And identifying that isn't about waging class war. No one wants war of any kind. People just want the American dream to be real for them, that if they work hard and play by the rules, they'll be able to live with financial security. But for most Americans, that American dream is an illusion. And then to have someone living in their ivory tower writing that somehow things are fine for everyday Americans, it's just so angering.
No, but the one thing I did agree with him on, productivity is important. I would love to see wages tied back to productivity like it used to be. You know, there's a great graph out there that shows, you know, from the end of World War II till about the middle of the 1970s, as productivity went up, wages went up, and they walked hand in hand. They were married. The idea of a meritocracy was possible. And then somewhere in the middle to late 70s, that broke. Productivity continued to go up at a 45-degree angle, and wages deadlined. And in fact, not just deadlined, but actually went down a little bit. So you see, from that period till now, the CEO class, the wealthy, the really wealthy in this country, saw their incomes grow over 900%, while the average worker saw a handful of percent, 2, 3, 5.
Rick, you know, if the minimum wage had grown at the rate of productivity since 1960, the minimum wage would be $22.50 today.
Yeah, I mean, so on this vein, this is where the one little nugget that I'll take from David Brooks, the rest of it's BS, but, you know, productivity is important, and we should be compensated for that productivity, because in every industry, productivity gains have happened. The problem is they're the folks who are sitting in the ivory towers who are the ones collecting all the gains.
You know, I agree, and I think a simple solution is let's give workers back all of the productivity gains that they lost, take the minimum wage to $22.50, and then from this point forward, let's grow the minimum wage by the rate of productivity from here on out.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Never mind inflation. Yeah. I want productivity. If that's it. And also what it does, and I think what David Brooks does masterfully for the right-wing argument, is it makes it not about something tangible, not something that I can see or something that I can personally have anything to do with. So it cripples us and makes us almost like, you know, there's nothing we can do. It's helpless.
Well, not to mention he creates this false moral equivalence between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, which is absolutely insane and testifies to one of the huge failings of the media during the past 4 years, which is confusing opinion for both sides of the issue. You know, just because you have your opinion doesn't mean it's equal in validity to someone else's opinion. Yet part of the reason we have Donald Trump as president is the media is so mindful of trotting out the other side of an issue, even if the other side of an issue is completely inane.
Yep. The both-sidism.
Oh, terrible.
Drives me insane, and you're right. But
why don't we, you know, 1 plus 1 equals 2. Let's bring on the person who argues that 1 plus 1 equals 4.
And that would be David Brooks, which is why, you know, when I started the day off with that article, and I normally ignore David Brooks, but this one was such an idiotic statement. And this is not new. This is what he's always done. He's always been an apologist for bad right-wing frames and ideology. He just does it in a way that infuriates everybody else. And isn't that his job?
Oh, I guess you're right. He's certainly speaking to his readers. You know, I mean, if only, you know, everyone had allies like the allies we have of the, you know, Democratic elites in Manhattan. I mean, the reality is the Democratic Party has fallen short in part because there are so many elites in Manhattan and Washington, D.C. and Cambridge, Massachusetts, who don't know the first thing about the life of everyday Americans and, you know, set neoliberal policies from their textbooks or their coffee shops in the Upper West Side.
Yeah. You know, I have a friend who was a former congressman from Ohio, and he said, you know, back when he was running first time he ran was in 1980. He said, you know, the entire state was basically, you know, a Democratic stronghold. For a Republican to get elected in Ohio, you know, you had to be a very moderate, you know, pro-labor Republican. And he said, look, you know, I would have never thought in my lifetime that, you know, Ohio would be a red state. And I said, well, look what the Democratic Party has done. And to your point, they walked away from labor. They've been, you know, basically centrist, pro-business Democrats who are just a little bit less bad than Republicans. And they haven't been the ones who have been fighting for that American dream of buying a little house with a picket fence and sending the kids to college and taking a little vacation and doing all of the things that my grandparents' generation was able to do that workers today cannot.
Well, Rick, you hit the nail on the head, which is so much of the Democratic Party is going in reverse. And we don't need to look any farther than the question of single-payer health insurance.
Right.
The fact that there is only one candidate in the Democratic primary who's truly fighting for single-payer health insurance, and everyone else is arguing as if this single-payer health insurance idea is something that came from outer space, from Neptune, is such a divorce from history. Democrats have been fighting for single-payer health insurance since Harry Truman. What happened to Hillary Clinton of 1993, who fought for single-payer health insurance?
And she got crushed. She got beaten up in 93, as did the Democratic Party. I mean, this is one of those weird moments.
But, you know, the facts and circumstances about why we lost in 93 on single payer have changed. And let me just unpack them one by one.
It's true.
First of all, people are more dissatisfied than ever with their health insurance. Second of all, people are also fed up with tying health insurance to their employer, as more people don't have an employer. You know, the nature of work has changed in the last 30 years, such that so many people are freelancers. And so people don't want their employer to be in charge of their health care in the same way they might have tolerated that 30 years ago. Third of all, health outcomes have deteriorated dramatically. As I said earlier, Americans are literally living shorter lives. For 3 straight years, the average lifespan of Americans has shrunk. Infant mortality is rising. And so you combine those factors, I think people are more disgusted with the current system than ever before in ways that they weren't 30 years ago.
No, you're absolutely right. And we didn't have these outrageous deductibles and copays. You know, I tell people, you know, I've had good union insurance most of my life. Back then, you just flashed a card and whatever you needed, you got. Even the union insurance that I have, which is still fantastic, you still have some copays and co-insurance and stuff like that, which have become new things. And I think you're right. I think people weren't ready in 93. And they also, the other part of this, they didn't have employers who were activists involved in their health care. I mean, whole contraception thing should be waking everybody up that, you know, if they're going to go after and target women for one thing, that could be anything at some point down the road.
That's right, Rick. But, you know, we need to talk about the intersection of race and health insurance more often, because to not do so overlooks the cold reality of this history. The biggest impediment to single-payer health insurance, in my judgment, has been racism. We've been fighting for single-payer health insurance since Harry Truman. Harry Truman almost got single-payer health insurance in the early 50s, and he was stopped because racist Southern Democrats at the time, right, when the racists were in the Democratic Party in the South, said, no, we don't want the government paying for health insurance for Black Americans, and we don't want to desegregate hospitals. And when you think about why is America the only developed country in the whole world that doesn't have single-payer health insurance, the only one, Britain, France, Germany, Australia, Japan, all these other developed economies that themselves have right-wing parties, right? Their right-wing parties support single-payer health insurance. Why doesn't America? Well, I'd argue because we are the most diverse country, and giving single-payer health insurance to every American means you're giving health insurance to black people and brown people, and there's an element in our politics that doesn't want to do that.
Yeah, that's just not about health insurance. That's about just about everything that goes into it. We are, without question, a racist country and a segregated country.
That's right.
So how do you change that? I mean, how do you get past, you know, someone? How do you get to someone's radical self-interest and then overcome their bias and their hatred?
Well, here's the irony. If you ask actual voters, including non-progressive, including non-democratic voters, how they feel about their insurance company, you get very negative responses. So we ought to take the question of single-payer health insurance directly to voters, because it's actually elites that are stopping it. If you go through West Virginia and Ohio and Michigan, states that the media calls Trump states or red states or whatever, you know, voters there want health insurance too. Voters there don't like health insurance companies. But we've become so timid as a Democratic Party. You know, there's this narrative that single-payer health insurance is somehow going to be a losing issue in the general election. I dispute that wholeheartedly. I think single-payer health insurance might be one of the most effective policies to win back Trump voters, because Trump voters' cousins and kids and parents are dying because they don't have medical care too.
Right. So you're not on the Bloomberg bandwagon, because everyone's telling me, no, Bloomberg can win, and Bloomberg's got the money. He's a billionaire businessman. We need a billionaire businessman like Trump to beat Trump. I'm going, no, that's what got us into this mess.
We need someone who's going to put front of mind and center of heart the interests of the nearly 8 out of 10 Americans who are living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
That's the president we need.
I'm right there with you. So, you know, again, you look at this moment, and I'm guessing you're a Sanders guy, right?
I haven't publicly announced who I'm supporting. I'm deciding between Sanders and Warren.
But, you know, the single-payer thing kind of, you know, leans you one way, right?
I hear you. I'm not going to.
So you're not coming out. I got you. I can't get that out of you either.
I'm not going to make news on this show, but I promise when I'm ready to publicly announce my endorsement, I will let you know.
You'll come back. All right, good stuff. I think it's important that we get out early and get on board here. But Joe, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. I'd love to have you come back again and talk more about this. I think it's so important. I think the work you're doing with Aspiration is really important. I hope folks will take a look at aspiration.com, right?
Thank you. Yes, that's right.
And I hope that folks will take a look, maybe move your accounts over and do some good in the world. Joe, I appreciate the time, man.
Thanks. Take care.
Good stuff. Joe Sandberg, co-founder of Aspiration Bank. Like I said, you know, if you've got some interest, there you go. But, you know, he makes an interesting point. And it's the point that I've been making for a very long time. You have to give people a reason to vote for a candidate. And it's not just to beat Donald Trump. I've said for a while, I want a Democratic Party who's going to fight for making people's lives better. I want a Democratic Party who's going to fight for making people's lives as good as Republicans want to make it bad. And I know this is but us versus them, and it is. Look at the policy choices that Republicans have moved forward on, and look at the Democratic choices of the last 2 years. Right now, there's a stark difference, and there's no, at this moment, there's no, hey, they're both the same. They're not, unless you get somebody who's a centrist. And I don't want another centrist Democrat who's going to be less bad than a Republican would be. Seriously. I seriously want somebody who's going to move a bold agenda, who's going to move us forward in a way that that we're going to be able to make big, bold changes. You know, it's just that simple to me. And I'm hoping Sanders is the guy. He's the person that I'm going to be voting for in the primary. But you know what? If it's Elizabeth Warren, I'm thrilled with that, too. It's just that simple. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you're going. As always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Cannot wait for the big impeachment trial to begin. Can't wait. I can't wait to find out whether it's going to be the big show trial that Fox News is going to be all tingly over, or if McConnell's going to do what I think he might do, which is just ram this through as fast as possible to get it off the plate. But we will find out on Tuesday. Going to be very interesting to see where this goes. Again, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time.